You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. There are many facets to the world of the paranormal that are often overlooked. In the classic 1979 book, Phone Calls from the Dead, D. Scott Rogo and Raymond Bayliss delved into perplexing cases involving alleged telephone calls from beyond. This area of research lay mostly dormant for almost 30 years after the publication of that book, when Dr. Carl Cooper took up the mantle and returned to this fascinating topic. In his newly updated version of Telephone Calls from the Dead, Dr. Cooper uncovers new cases and postulates on the paranormal power over bereavement, grief, and loss. But before that, as always, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. A big thank you to my latest patron, Rebecca, and thank you to each and every one of you that continue to support me and Mysteries and Monsters. It is greatly appreciated. You can find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media platforms. Please visit the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. And thank you to everybody that helped us get over 3,000 subscribers. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, episodes, and Mysteries and Monsters merchandise. Our intro and outro music are performed by the wonderful Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. And of course, the show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. So the question remains, just how would you react to a telephone call from the dead? For many of us who lose a loved one, there is often an overriding desire for one last chance to talk to them, or just to hear their voices one more time. In 1979, the seminal book, Phone Calls from the Dead, by D. Scott Rogo and Raymond Bayliss, delved into the incredible reports that departed loved ones had been trying to make one last call. This perplexing, emotive and baffling part of the paranormal has lain dormant for many years. But thankfully for us, Dr. Callum Cooper has taken up the gauntlet in his newly updated book, Telephone Calls from the Dead. Carl, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters, sir.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me, Paul.
You are always welcome. It's a real pleasure, especially when I get hold of a book on a topic which for me is one of those things that I've kind of rediscovered since I started doing the show back in 2019, that I was aware of this. Primarily, strangely enough, I saw an online lecture you gave last year for the Australian Society for Psychical Research, and you included a clip of Rogo speaking on In Search Of, and I'd seen that episode six or seven years ago. I basically binged the entire series a few years ago, and so that one particularly stuck out to me because I've always been very interested in certain weirder aspects of the paranormal, Cal, and this for me is one of those that comes well indeed under the umbrella of the stranger parts of parapsychology.
What a strange link that you found it through that. So that was the Australian Institute for Parapsychological Research. Mm. And I remember giving that talk because I was staying in a hotel in Northampton because the night before I was at an award ceremony at the university, and I got an award for excellence in doctoral supervision. And most of my doctorates that I supervise are doing something on parapsychology.
Yeah.
And then I had to get up at 5 a.m. or something like that in the hotel room, flip open the laptop, and then do this talk on Phone Calls from the Dead, which I hadn't really done a full talk like that in a while. Mm. So I'm glad that it ran so smoothly with all the Wi-Fi working and the massive time differences. But yeah, In Search Of, hosted by Leonard Nimoy. And I've played that clip so many times now, and I hope it doesn't seem trivial to audiences that see it, because they're seeing it for the first time. For me, I've seen it so many times now. Mm. But it's a nice example of, here is one of the researchers, and he sat in the American Society for Psychical Research talking about his research in the book, and then Mary Meredith gives her case of an unusual phone call, saying, these are just how they play out. She was just washing the pots when all of a sudden, boom, and then something happens. No one sat there grieving and wishing they could have a phone call. No one's talking about this phenomena and then it happens. They're going about their daily business. Something unusual happens. They deal with it as it happens. And it's only until after it happens, they start to think, that was really odd. And that is how the majority of spontaneous cases day to day seem to happen, even in a haunted location. You might speak to someone in period costume and chat about a certain room, go away and speak to someone else and say, wow, it's great, you've got people in period costume today. No, we haven't. I beg your pardon. No, no one's here in period costume. But I've just been speaking to someone. Oh, and then things start to tie together and people tell you about the tale of the certain ghost in a certain room wearing certain things. Or after that phone call, you discover that the person that you were speaking to had actually died before that call took place. The impossible seems to have happened. So that's what parapsychology has been looking at for 150 years or so, and that's what led to this book specifically on the telephone and what happens with telephone communication.
I think as well, one of the great aspects of your book is that you've given us this history of this, because I think often sometimes we can presume that these things seem to be modern investigations, Cal, and yet quite clearly, even in the early days of telecommunications and the varieties and the reliabilities obviously were not what they are these days, though I suppose it depends which mobile network some of us are on. Certain people were always interested, and I find the part where it seems to sort of begin to become investigated is obviously during the rebirth of spiritualism in the United Kingdom after the First World War. There seems to be a lot there that sort of sets wheels in motion, and you've got Edison obviously working in the States claiming to create this impossible telephone that seems to be another tantalizing, did he really, or was he just being the arch promoter that he was often known for, Kyle, in that regard, that he just said he was going to do it, but was he really, or was he just, I mean, some people would say somebody else would have done it, he'd have stolen it anyway, but...
I think you're right. I think you're right. There is that kind of panic moment about, you know, this could cause a lot of money. This could cause a massive income if you could commercialize a telephone that anyone could buy to speak to your deceased relative. Mm. And I think at that time in 1920, when other people were coming forward in articles for some of the latest psychical research journals saying they had made such a telephone, no wonder he is speaking to Scientific American and doing an interview saying, oh, by the way, I'm making a telephone that will contact the dead and is going to have these kinds of instruments. This is what I'm going to design it for. I think he's panicking and attempting to jump on the bandwagon because he's created some incredible inventions, but not something like this. And yet he has got a massive interest in psychical research. His parents were spiritualists. He hired lab assistants that were spiritualists, some of them Polish-American mediums. And so after they'd done a day's work and they'd been lab assistants, they then turned to the seance when it came to the evening in the lab, and they would hold seances. So I think Edison was in panic mode. So, you know, you do laugh and it has got that element of humor, but I think you're right as well. He thought, wow, you know, this is something that's important. And if it's real, if people have been doing this, I need to make one of these as well.
Yeah. So what was it about Rogo and Bayliss's work that got under your skin so much, Cal? Because often when we look at the modern investigations of the paranormal or parapsychology over the last 15 or 20 years, things like audio phenomenon seems to depend, has gone into sort of the gadget areas, which is a different kettle of fish and something I'm not overly keen on, because I think there's a lot of oral pareidolia that goes on there, and I think a lot of it is people grasping at sort of audible straws, as it were. Whereas this, for me, is very similar, yet very distinct from EVP. That I think there was clearly a lot of research that was going on in specific periods of the last 50 or 60 years, and they both seem to have completely dropped out of fashion. And yet now, thanks to your updated book and other researchers, it seems that people are looking back at this seriously. Why did it get under your skin so much? Because I would imagine it was quite a niche aspect of parapsychology that you decided to focus on.
Well, I wouldn't say it got under my skin. We tend to say that's more something that's kind of an irritant to you, and then you act on it. This is more that I was probably, I didn't spot it. It's like the shiny penny on the floor that you've not quite spotted, but you do want to eventually recognize it and pick it up and think, you know, for your own benefit, it could be good luck.
Yes.
And so I will pick it up, but you've not quite noticed it in the first glance. You notice it on the second or third. And it was like that. I was buying books by Rogo and Bayliss. and nothing had been reprinted recently. It wasn't until about 2006, 5, 6, something like that, that Anomalous Books were reprinting some of Rogo's books, about 6 or 7 of them. But he did around 30 by the time that he unfortunately was murdered in 1990.
Yes.
But one of those books was Phone Calls from the Dead. But he co-authored it with his own mentor, Raymond Bayliss, who was a landscape painter. I'm sat literally next to several of his paintings that I have in my own home. They're beautiful artists.
Wow.
And yet he was a walking encyclopedia for psychical research. And that really rubbed off on D. Scott Rogo as well. He read widely. And his own home library, he had it done up by himself in the Dewey Decimal System for library categorization. So he got such a vast home library. And yet he got a relatively small house in Northridge, California as a bachelor. And so he was just making sure he got all of the research that he needed to hand to keep literally churning out 2 books a year, as well as loads of editorials and articles. I got this book and just saw, oh, Phone Calls from the Dead, I haven't got that one. Oh, look, they've authored that one together. That's unique. But put it to one side. I was then carrying on with my work as an undergraduate student in psychology and reading bits and bobs of their work. But then all of a sudden on MSN News, there was this story about a train collision that had happened within days of me spotting it, 2009, of Charles Peck being in this train collision and the family picking up the phone saying, don't worry, rescuers are on their way. We're watching it now on the telly, but they're coming to help you. Don't worry, Dad. And then, you know, son or daughter or wife are receiving these calls. And yet when they call back, it goes straight to voicemail or as though the phone is switched off or dead. And at 3:30 a.m., somewhere around there, they stopped receiving these repeated calls to their phones and rescuers have found his body. And because he's so close to the front of the train, they realize he's died on first impact, which would be around 10 p.m. or something like that. So yet 5 hours afterwards, they're still receiving these repeated calls. But they don't know that. What does the skeptic in me say? Well, his phone's been tossed in the wreckage. They've not found it. It's been crushed. Or it's broken in some way and it's repeatedly calling the last people in its call register because he's on his way home. That's his wife, that's his children, whoever he was calling and texting. But what's happened there? Well, they've interpreted it as a phone call from the dead. The media has reported it as a phone call from the dead. And I had bought this book, Phone Calls from the Dead, but from 1979, so 30 years prior. And I thought, okay, I'm going to read this. And I read it cover to cover and I thought, whoa, this is vastly different. These are documented conversations that are transcribed and written into some of these accounts, not just the phone ringing and associating it with someone that is unwell or is dying or has just died or has been dead for some time. So what's going on there? Are there people actually reporting full-on conversations, not just interpretation of this? So that's what, you know, as you say, what got under my skin. It was, I've got that book. Now I need to have a thorough look at this. So I went through it and then I started writing some articles on it. I started trying to find new cases. I wrote an article for Anomaly, which is the journal of ASAP, the Association for the Scientific Study of Anomalous Phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
I did an article on text messages from the dead for the magazine of the Society for Psychical Research. And I did a peer-reviewed paper on how we critically assess these cases when they come to us using a method called Occam's Razor for the Australian Journal of Parapsychology. And I was building all of these kind of articles and professional academic papers. And a good friend of mine in Portsmouth, south coast of the UK, said, I have some friends that have a publishing house in Portsmouth. Why don't you expand these articles into a book about this study? So I did. So I teamed up with Tricorn Books, and that's what started the book project to have Telephone Calls from the Dead, which is essentially a volume 2 to the original.
So what was it that attracted you to parapsychology and investigating further? Because obviously a lot of your master's and your degree in psychology, Kat, you focus a lot on bereavement and dealing with those kinds of issues, as well as other facets of psychology that it would, well, not to me, because I've spoken to several parapsychologists over the years, and some of them are very interesting paths how they end up there. Was it something that you were interested in prior to this, or was it just something that you thought connected with dealing with bereavements and the way this can affect grief and people's health and the things that go on that, once again, have probably not been investigated or researched as much as they perhaps have. And I know you touch on it in the book where you talk about certain cases where couples, where one passes away and one tends to follow soon after. And I know two of my friends whose grandparents both had that situation where they passed away within a week or two of each other, which for me is quite odd. But I think these are aspects when we look at the body and the mind in the aftermath of a bereavement that perhaps doesn't get the focus or the attention or the research that it deserves. So for you, was it something that was a natural progression moving on from that kind of psychological work?
It sort of was, in terms of finding some sort of grounding or, I suppose, employability factor in doing a PhD. And so once I'd done my undergraduate and my master's, which with both dissertations, my undergraduate, I did a dissertation on looking at the sense of being stared at, which yes. Rupert Sheldrake has done a lot of research on, who's a good friend and colleague of mine. And then my master's, I was looking at creativity in people's views on what the afterlife may be, and whether the more creative an afterlife view is, does it lessen death anxiety? So that's very specific, and I've not really done anything with that master's dissertation. We've referenced it in a few things when we've made scales for other things where we've validated scales on afterlife beliefs. So it's had its sort of time in its play. But for the PhD, it initially was going to have more of a spin on counselling and counselling people who had had anomalous experiences around bereavement. I'm not a counsellor. I'm not registered with the British Association for Counselling and Psychotherapy. And so I didn't really want to go down that route. After about 2 or 3 months into the PhD, I thought, what I'll do is more so look at the benefits of people having these experiences following loss and look at it that way, because ethically, all I'm saying on paper is I'm interviewing these people. I will make it very clear to them I am not counseling them. But when you approach 50 people that have had these experiences and you say you're a psychologist and this is what I'm looking at, they treat it as a counseling session anyway. You can't take that from them, but the ethics board still needs to know that you're making it very clear I'm not counselling you, I'm interviewing you, but you can still ask me as many questions as you like,
yes,
and take advantage of the fact that you are speaking to a psychologist for the next 1 to 2 hours. So, you know, now's your time. And they reveled in it. Would give anyone the platform to talk about their exceptional experiences, be it around bereavement or not, they will revel in it because they know they're not going to be mocked. There's no stigma around it. They are speaking to someone that is well-read in this area. They're going to offer suggestions, advice, talk about the impact that it's had. And that was the main thing. My work looking at exceptional experiences around death, including the telephone calls from the dead, is not in many ways to challenge did it or didn't it happen. It's that you are adamant that it did. So what did it do for you? If you believe that is the case, why? What's it doing for you? So it's more so looking at positive psychology or personal well-being and bereavement and coping strategies, because you've got a life to live beyond that loss of that person. So how does that experience fit in your worldview, and how are you carrying it forward to benefit you? That you are using it to your own gain rather than saying, oh, this experience was a hindrance. This has really scared me to death now about the idea of dying. People don't really say that. It's in the absolute 1 to 2 percentile minority that people have a really scary experience, unusual experience, exceptional, or if we want to use the dirty words, paranormal or supernatural. It's very, very low around that to say it was a negative experience. People find them very positive, calming, affirming, comforting experiences. So that's what I was looking at for my PhD. The main thing I was looking at was an aspect of positive psychology, one of our emotional traits. I went to my supervisor, Dr. Graham Mitchell, who's no longer with us. He unfortunately passed away just after my PhD finished. He'd had a very bad accident midway into me doing my PhD. But I went to him in his office one day and I said, Graham, what do you think I should do to actually get this parapsychological topic firmly embedded within positive psychology? And he looked at me, and in my memory, I'm sort of leant against the filing cabinet and I looked at him. It was the shortest meeting ever. He smirks and looked at me and he just said, look at hope. And that was it. And I went, all right. And I just left the office. And I went and started reading everything I could on the psychology of hope and the fact that it really started to be recognized in the 1960s. It's a type of goal attainment. There's a big difference between wishing for something and hoping for something. We tend to say that hope involves human actions. You're actually doing something about trying to get whatever it is that you want, or you're trying to look for things that support your idea of achieving the goals that you want to achieve. Whereas wishing is just that needless wanting without doing anything about it. And it's quite selfless in some ways. I wish I could win the lottery.
Yeah.
Do you ever buy any tickets? No. Well, then how the hell are you going to win it? Because I'm going to blow in your direction like Charlie in the Chocolate Factory, and you find the golden ticket sitting in the gutter or something like that. You found the pound note that lets you get it. No. It's not going to happen like that. You've got to show some positive action. You've got to be proactive. Even if it's on a very low level, you're at least starting the small stones of an avalanche. So all you have to do is throw those pebbles and they will gather into stones and rocks and boulders, and that causes the avalanche. So do something about it. How does that fit within these experiences? Well, they're using them as that stimulus for saying, I'm okay. I don't have to spend the rest of my life after I lose someone in grief or worrying about my own mortality. I've had one of these special experiences. I dreamt about the dead. I had a telephone call from the dead. I sensed their presence. And that has given me something very special that tells me that I don't need to be worried. And it's a few things. One, they're watching me all the time, in terms of that's my personal interpretation. I, as a parapsychologist, don't need to challenge that. It would just be damaging if I gave them the conventional explanations for why I think it's not the dead. Why would I take that experience away from you? I see as a well-being factor, it's doing something for you. Mm. So let's look at that. So yeah, they're around me. They're supporting me. This person is watching over me beyond death. And I've read about this. So that makes the experience more concrete. I've heard about these experiences. That makes it more concrete. I have a friend that had similar experiences. That makes it more concrete. So when I finally die, things are going to happen. And it's not going to be a win-lose situation. It's going to be a win-neutral situation. What's the win? Well, because of these experiences, it suggests they're living on. So the win is I'll be reunited with them. That's great. That's lovely. That's what the experience is doing for me. It's suggesting they've lived on, so I will join them one day. And what's the neutral? You're dead and consciousness is extinct, so you won't know about it. That's not a bad thing.
Yeah.
You won't know about it. It's completely grey and neutral. You won't know. So you'll either win or just not know that you've lost. That's it. That is it. And so it's so, so positive. If you have one of these experiences, good for you. If you don't, what would I recommend? I was asked this once at Nottingham Skeptics in the Pub. And I said, as much as this is not what a skeptical audience would want to hear, if you've not had a spontaneous experience after loss, either read about these experiences and various works that have been done, or, you know, if you're edging your bets, go and just try out, maybe take a friend along, try out a one-to-one reading with a medium and see if that feels good for you. If you're really suffering with loss that much, do it. It's seen as a form of entertainment. But if you are taking something away from it that makes you feel good, why should anyone have the right to sit down with you and take that experience away from you? I'm a psychologist, first and foremost. I want you to be well. I want you to be happy. I will certainly out any mediums that are clearly doing something unethically or fraudulently. But if you have had a good experience, they've given you a fair reading and they believe they're doing what they're doing, it's not for me to tell you what I think is actually going on with that medium and what I know about cold reading and Barnum's. You've had a good experience. So if you've not had it naturally, you could go to one of these mediums and have these experiences. So, yeah, I mean, it's a long-winded answer to your question, but that is why that's how I sidestepped into bereavement research, really, completely under the banner of parapsychology, because I was helping manage the third year module in parapsychology in a psychology degree, and I'm still involved in that now.
Well, I think it's an interesting aspect that you've touched on there in regards to that, because it's quite pertinent in regards to my personal experience. One of my mum's best friends, her husband died very suddenly, Cal, completely out of the blue.
Yeah.
And she has spent the best part of a year visiting mediums probably on a weekly basis because she's desperate to get that response. And obviously I come from a very open-minded family in regards to the paranormal and parapsychology in general. And so my mum's gone as a kind of chaperone because, like you say, she's very open-minded, but she's also very switched on in regards to things like cold reading and I saw her yesterday and she was telling me about the latest one she'd gone, and she just said, yeah, it was just a load of people cold reading, and she goes in with pre-planned questions about her own life knowing that if she doesn't get the specific answer, she knows someone's trying to pull the wool over her eyes. And for me, because this has been going on for quite a while, Kyle, I'm beginning to think this has gone from trying to find closure to becoming an obsession. And I think, especially for yourself, I would imagine that you've come across cases like that, because I think one of those things that we often overlook when it comes to bereavement and grief and loss, and I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this, is I've always tried to be, as in my working life and my friendship circle and my family life, to be very supportive of others that have lost, and being that kind of person that's very open. And if people just want to talk about how they feel and let them have a good cry or whatever, then I would like to be that board for them to be able to talk to regardless. And I don't put a time limit on grief. And I've found it incredible, especially in my professional life, the amount of people, especially in managerial positions, who have had staff who have lost someone or even pets, that they seem to put a time limit on when somebody should be over grieving, Cal. Is that something that you've seen often in the modern era, as through your work in bereavement and speaking with people dealing with loss and grief and the ramifications of it? Or is it, as I say, in regards to the situation with my mum's friend, that it can mushroom into this kind of obsessive, I need a contact, I need clarity, I need confirmation or closure even?
Can it mushroom into? I think, so there's two things there. One is there a time limit on bereavement? And the second one is an addictive quality to going to see mediums. So is there a timeline on bereavement? It's hard to tell, because it's hard to really knuckle down as to how much bereavement is impacting on someone. We even have labels of clinical bereavement, where it's affecting someone so much that they do need to go and see a clinical psychologist or psychotherapist to really talk about how this is affecting them. So what is bereavement? Well, bereavement is separation anxiety, and we always think about the word bereavement in relation to dead people, but that's not so. You could be really attached to a personal artifact that took you a lot of time to save the money and buy, and you've lost it, or it's been stolen, or it's been broken. And it breaks your heart that someone has stolen it, or it has been broken, and you cannot get a replacement. It was a one and only, one off, and it's because of who gave it to you or whatever, and it's gone. But you were so attached to that inanimate object, whatever it may be. You may end up in an accident and you lose your hands, your arm, your leg, amputee. You have lost something that you expected to be with you for the entirety of your life. It's gone. Separation anxiety. You are in panic and grief mode for the fact that is the way of it, and you're not going to get it reattached. It is gone. How am I going to live life moving forward? You have a long-term partner, but you split up. And it's unexpected. You didn't want that to be the case, and you are very hurt by the breakup. Well, that hurt, that heartache, is a bereavement, because you are thinking about, oh my God, that life moving forward is going to be without this person. And it's going to be without some of that friendship circle that only existed because of them, because it was their friends and their family. I've got to move forward and start a new chapter without some of those people in it. It won't be the same anymore as they were. So bereavement has many aspects to it, not just through loss of a person through death, but it's just one type of bereavement. And you can have low grief death, where you know you're about to lose something, be it that person or those other elements I mentioned, or high grief death, where it's completely unexpected. And if we stick to people, you kiss them goodbye in the morning, you've made them a cup of coffee or whatever in a travel flask, goodbye, have a good day at work, I'll see you later, very casual. But then 2 hours later, the police turn up at your door and they say, I'm sorry, I died in the car crash. And, you know, what, how, so many questions, where were they? What was going on with it? It's just full of questions, and it's not going to help. And then it's also full of the what ifs. If only I kept them talking with me another 5 more minutes. If only, you know, they'd stayed home and worked today rather than gone into the office. And it's too many ifs. Ifs and ands were buts and pans ago. Ifs and ands were pots and pans, but alas, they never were. It's terrible when people get into that situation where they think about the ifs and ands. It happened. Do not beat yourself up about the fact of what you could have done, you couldn't have done. You treated that day as any other, and you were living it to its fullest, and that's all you can do. Don't think you can take back the time. And so bereavement is extremely complex, and it could last a few months where it really hurt and you learn to pick yourself up and move forward and be stronger from that loss. And it could be from going out more, going on walks, turning to the gym, changing your diet, doing some writing therapy. It's a number of things. I've been through it myself, and I did those very things as well. I wrote things down I wish I could have said. I thought about things in different ways and then decided, don't think about them anymore. You've done enough of that. You've had your time of doing that. You now put it to bed. You can't keep beating yourself up. I turned to the gym. I changed my diet. Did a number of things. I got more proactive with work. It affects people in different ways. But eventually you cope with it and you get stronger. These experiences help in that instance. They facilitate that gap of loss. And they inspire hope in many ways. Mm. And so the first part of your question was, how long does grief last? The second part, what was that second part? What was it?
It was about the addictive qualities of chasing mediums.
Qualities. Absolutely. Oh, my goodness. That's a big question. And I've talked about that with colleagues before. So if we're specifically looking at people turning to mediumship, I've said that there needs to be some papers on this. And as far as I'm aware, there aren't. But when there's a monetary value involved in it, absolutely. We need to actually look at journals like Bereavement Care, a mega journal of death and dying. They're the absolute place where we need to fire some research papers on this. And it'd be very simple in terms of asking out about people that either have or know people that have repeatedly gone to mediums where they've had to pay for the process. Eventually, you have got to cope with your own bereavement and loss. If you have spontaneous experiences like a telephone call from the dead, like a sense of presence, like dreaming of the dead, great. But if you're paying to facilitate one of these experiences, you need to sort of tell yourself when enough is enough. I think a year is, that's the cutoff point. You shouldn't be going beyond 12 months of still needing this. You need to stand on your own 2 feet and accept the loss and start to play on how you've grown as a person since then. If you haven't, then you really do need to start speaking to your GP and possible referral for psychotherapy or counselling, or just seek independent counselling with it. The medium themselves, again, if they're acting in a way that they're very honest and sincere about what they're doing, they are acting as a form of counsellor, which in that case, that type of scenario, I don't have a problem with. Yeah. Because I'm not testing their claims. I'm looking at the clinical parapsychology side, which is, how are they benefiting you? How is it impacting your well-being? Because we're dealing with loss here. So the addictive quality, I think, is really important. I would like to look at some instances where people have repeatedly gone back and spent a lot of money and they've not learned to stand on their own 2 feet following a personal loss. So, Paul, you've hit on a big topic there that I think is very much under-researched. And we all know about it. We've heard of these people that repeatedly go back and, you know, they're forever going to these one-to-one mediums and it costs, I don't know, £30-40 for an hour's reading, but they're doing it over and over and over again. And it's like the loss is still fresh for them, when for many other people, that they would have found some coping strategy within a few months. And yet this is a year down the line. So, yeah, it's a big topic and it does need returning to, but we are aware of it. And I think a year, that's it. You cut it off there. If it's going on beyond that, we've got a problem.
I think one of the aspects of this is that there are so many unregulated mediums out there, Cal, that it often becomes a sort of a word of a mouth or a friend recommendation. I'm amazed how many meetings my mum's been to, because I didn't know there were so many mediums acting in the South Yorkshire area. I find that as phenomenal as a sort of secondary issue to this, that because she's not going to see the same people over and over again. She's going around and around to different ones. And it's, you know, she's travelling fair different, you know, 15, 20 miles sometimes to go and see people. And I find that remarkable, that there are so many people in such a short distance that she's able to visit for, you know, paying up to, as I think the most she's paid is £30-40 for a reading. But yeah. Some she's gone and there's like 20 people, then they all pay a fiver. And I find that as remarkable, that there are these avenues for people to sort of get their fix, as it were, Cal, in regards to chasing that answer, regardless of whether they're going to get anything. Because it seems, like you say, that it gets... This is what I was interested to hear your thoughts on, because for me personally, I think it's got to the point where it needs professional help, personally.
Mm. No, you're right. I mean, I think for advice of anyone that's going through this and they have seen mediums, if you believe in the process that you're going through, if it feels comforting for you, you're using it as a very absurd pick and mix to go around a number of mediums. If you had a counsellor for anything, work stress or whatever, you wouldn't pick another one the next week. You would stick with the one that knows about you.
Yes.
You would stick with the one that you have told your story to and knows your journey. Because if you keep then picking a new counsellor every week, you've got to start again. If you were going through a legal case, you've got to tell the lawyer who you are and what your backstory is and what your take is on the issue that you're dealing with in the courts. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't then pick another one the next week or after the court trial that you do for the next bit of the court trial, because you've got to start again. You need some contingency, with that and continuity. So stick with the same one, because if you believe they're doing what they're doing and they claim that they're doing what they're doing, then they're not going to come out with the same things. If they believe they're talking to the dead, then they should be coming out with different information that is still very specific to you that you can validate and say, oh my goodness, that's very impressive. Yes, they absolutely did that, rather than churning out the same story. If they're churning out the same story, then that's showing a problem with the medium, and that maybe they are not doing it by the means that they suggest they are. Mm. But surely that should send the alarm bells ringing for you that maybe you shouldn't be going to see mediums. Because if you're then just saying, well, I'll pick another one, then I'll pick another one, then I'll pick another one, that you are looking for something that confirms what you're looking for. And that starts to also become a problem as well, that you're only satisfied until they tell you what you want to hear. Well, actually, you're probably better just actually hearing from your friends what you want to hear, rather than from someone that claims that they're talking to the dead.
Mm.
And so, I'm all for it with the medium that claims that they're doing what they're doing. And if they're doing it and you were happy in the first instance, stick with them like a counsellor, like a lawyer, like someone that should know your story, and don't keep going around. Keep it consistent, because then you will know, is it worth going back to them for an update? Maybe not. If you've got nothing new to talk to a counsellor about, you're not going to pay for another 40, 50, 60 pound hours long session to tell them something they already know.
Yes.
You're going to wait until something else has happened in your life to say, we need to chat for an hour. This has happened. I need your perspective based on everything you already know. Absolutely, that's justified. And again, with the medium, if you already know what they've said and nothing new has happened to you, you're not going to go back to them until there's a need to go back to them.
Mm.
And so clearly there's a need if you're going around loads of them, because you're not satisfied. Yeah. And you're not satisfied, and you're spending all this money as well. So yeah, it's like a landmine territory there. So that's my advice to anyone listening that has been to mediums. If you believe in that process and you found one that you had a good experience with, leave it there. Stick with them. What is the point of just going around a load of people and doing that? They should be there for your benefit as and when you need them. Don't turn it into just finding confirmations.
Well, I mean, secondary, before I dive into a couple of the cases from the book, Cal, I'm always interested as well, because for me, there's another kind of aspect of this that kind of links grief, bereavement and the paranormal here. And it's often the case where you have certain members of a family and someone they all love passes away. And say you've got four children whose parent passes away, and one or two of them receives a message from beyond, or a visitation, or even a phone call, for example. And the other two don't. Have you come across cases like that? Because often in the reports I've heard and I've read about, people seem to think that it's almost as if it's on tap, it's on demand. And why are they getting a visit and I'm not? Did they not love me as much? Have you, when you've been doing studies or with some of your colleagues and had discussions of the like, is that a topic that has occasionally popped into conversation?
Yeah, so not specifically with the telephone calls from the dead, but we found it with day-to-day after-death communications, as they're called, or post-death experiences or contacts with the deceased. So I'm working with a team of researchers that we've been funded to do this on a large scale. We've published papers in British Journal of Psychiatry Open, Evolution Psychiatrique, Explore, Mega Journal of Death and Dying. And one of our colleagues that initiated getting funding to do this is Evelyn Elsa Esser. And she's based in Geneva. I think one of the best books anyone listening to this can buy, if they're just interested in the broad range of after-death communications, is her book, Evelyn Elsa Esser, Spontaneous Contacts with the Deceased. That's what it's called. And the subtitle is A Large-Scale International Survey Reveals the Circumstances, Lived Experiences, and Beneficial Impacts of After-Death Communications. And it shows within the first few pages that this is a survey, a big scale that went out between Evelyn, Professor Chris Rowe, myself and David Lorimer, and also our research assistant as well, not to forget her, Sophie Morrison, looking into all this data. That was a French, Spanish and English survey where we got 1,000 respondents initially, and now we're doing it in Dutch, German and Chinese. But when I was initially doing this with part of my PhD, which sparked Chris Rowe meeting up with Evelyn at a funders event for what we ended up doing, I'd already talked about an instance by Julian Burton. Now, Julian Burton was sort of the second known person to do a doctorate in this area. The first person was Dewi Rees, D-E-W-I, as in the Welsh equivalent of David. Mm. He was a general practitioner in North Wales, and his medical doctorate, he was already a doctor in general practice, but he went and did a research degree, a medical doctorate, under the banner of psychiatry at King's College London, which became his very famous paper, Hallucinations of Widowhood, in the British Medical Journal in 1971.
Mm.
And he'd interviewed 293 widows and widowers about their experiences. Initially, it was just about the negative impacts of bereavement. But he discovered some of them said, oh, yeah, after they passed away, I felt their presence around me still. So that's what all of his doctorate was. He went back and re-interviewed them about this sense of presence phenomena all the way through to apparitions. That's 1971. By the late 1970s, Julian Burton, who was an American actor and his undergraduate degree was in theatre studies, he'd done some sort of Hammer horror type films. His most famous was called A Bucket of Blood.
Yes.
He was in that film. He went back to schooling and higher education. He went to a place called International College in America to do his PhD because he'd had an experience regarding his mother that related to his sister. On the very point of your question, what about some siblings that have an experience and the others don't? How do they react to that? So he recounts his experience. I haven't got it in front of me, but it was more or less like this. He says, I was entertaining guests with my wife and I was in the kitchen cutting a pineapple when all of a sudden I felt the presence of someone behind me to my left. When I looked around to see who was there, they'd already passed around to my right. So I turned around and looked over to my right. When I looked, I saw my mother standing there, clear as day, wearing a pale, detailed blue gown. Ma, I exclaimed. And then all of a sudden, she dissolved. She didn't disappear. She steadily dissolved and faded away. Next few days later, he called his sister to recount this experience. It had been some 9 months after their mother had passed away. He said, I saw her apparition in the kitchen. Absolutely strange experience, and we had guests over, and she's distraught. His sister on the telephone is distraught. Why not me? I had such a strong bond with mother. I was with her all the time. That doesn't make sense. I haven't had one of these experiences. And Julian then starts to describe what the apparition looked like. She was wearing this pale, detailed blue gown that I've never seen before. He starts to discuss what it looked like. Absolute shock for the sister. That's it. That's my message from mother. Julian asks why. Why does that make sense to you? 2 or 3 weeks before their mother died, they did their regular shopping trips together and they went to try on shoes and clothes. And their mother tried on to that exact description, a pale blue detailed gown. And she thought about buying it for herself, but it was some $400 or $500. And she couldn't think about parting that much money for such a garment. She ummed and ahed, should I treat myself? Shouldn't I? But she didn't. And yet through Julian's experience, seeing his mother and didn't recognize the clothing and prompted so much to tell his sister, I have seen the ghost of our mother, and then describes it. There's an element in there that is specifically, as far as they interpret it, for the sister. She's initially distraught. I didn't get the experience. Why not you? But there's a message within that experience, and it's through the clothing that is for her. So yeah, those experiences, I know it's a long-winded explanation, but those experiences do come up. Why do some siblings do, some don't? Well, we get those instances, but if you start to break down the experience, sometimes the other people who didn't have an experience, the experience for the other person contains elements that might be for another person because it doesn't make sense to them.
Mm.
So yeah, it is noted, it is on record, and there they are.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, there are so many little assets and pointers that are wrapped up in this that I think sometimes, because we sometimes, when people talk about the paranormal or life after death or whatever it may be, I think often people focus on the big hitters, Cal. And occasionally, these are the aspects of it that I find fascinating, where you've got these kinds of things that seem to be quite common, but not a lot of people talk about for whatever reason. And I'm not sure whether that's due to time constraints or funding or just general interest. Obviously, most parapsychological problems in regards to research are down to the funding available. But I think as we look at certain aspects of it, I think there are these little parts of it that are deeply fascinating, because they're for me, I think they're rich wells of personal experience that can offer us even more questions based on people's experiences, such as that one. Why would someone see a spirit of their mum in clothes they didn't recognise that would only be relevant to his sister? You would say, well, why didn't she just appear to the sister? But therefore, it's almost as if she's come to the son to sort of say, I'm okay, everything's fine. And for him to relay a message, perhaps because he was a better conduit and he would have dealt with it better than the daughter, perhaps. Who knows?
Well, there are a few things with him. One, he was quite sceptical of these experiences, but it's because of that experience he went back to higher education, did his PhD, and did surveys on these very experiences around the time of death to ask people about it. And he targeted colleges and universities and their psychology departments and asked staff and students. So there was that. And also, I think he was quite sceptical of these experiences, and he found it odd within the apparition that he saw that she was looking a lot younger than he remembered his mum to be. He describes her as young and vibrant and glowing, which is also very typical as well. So it's not as though he has seen what he expected to see. He's seen his mum looking younger and healthier and vibrant and glowing, and she's wearing clothes that aren't hers. Mm. I mean, that's really unique. And the only person that would know about those clothes was his sister. So if it is not some form of contact from the dead, it's some form of telepathic experience from his sister, who is grief-stricken, who at that very moment while he's cutting a pineapple and getting food ready to entertain the guests they've already got round, that he tunes in to his sister's thoughts and feelings and misery and woe, and sees what he expects to see, which is this vision of the mother. But he's already said, I wasn't expecting to see anything like that. I'd already succumbed to the bereavement. It passed, time had passed. I wasn't even thinking about it, but he saw her. She was younger, she was vibrant and wearing clothes that he didn't recognize, but perfectly understood by his sister. Was his sister responsible for the thing that he saw? Some form of hallucination while he was merrily cutting a pineapple in his own, you know, mindset, completely in a state of flow, as we might call it. Signified by Malay Chick Sempny High, the psychologist. Time flies when you're having fun. You're just in the zone, doing what you're doing. You're on autopilot. You're in that altered state of consciousness. Or was it genuinely some aspect of his mum from beyond the grave giving him some sort of message that would give some confirmatory element to his sister? Who knows? These are the important philosophical questions that these experiences bring up, because they certainly don't throw at us instantly some very obvious conventional explanations. And they are there. But in these kinds of circumstances, they're not obvious.
Mm. I suppose this is perfectly leads into telephone calls from the dead, because often there are numerous plausible explanations for what has happened, that people have selective amnesia, Cal, that people are grief-stricken and want the call to be who they wish to hear from, or it's a dream, or they are in some kind of waking hypnotic state or whatever. And yet, for me, I think when you look at that, that would suggest that, firstly, well, if that's the case, there should be far more of these that are reported than there are, because Rogue One Bayliss, I think, what did they get, around 50 in their original study? And the Italian gentleman that did the follow-up study later on didn't have many either. I think he only had, what was it, about 40 as well?
Rogue had 50 accounts.
Yeah. So for me, when you think of all the people that are grief-stricken and suffer from bereavement, and the amount of people that have telephones, and the amount of people that feel a deep, powerful sense of loss, I find it hard to believe that only so many cases, especially when you think of how many people are classed as believers in the paranormal, Cal. That would suggest that we should have a lot more of these accounts. And yet the thing that I've always found this phenomenon so striking is they seem to be so rare and of varying quality as well. We don't get people having... I mean, there are a couple of occasions where people do seem to have very long-winded back and forth conversations, but they seem to be in the minority, whereas a lot of them seem to be quite short, simple, sporadic. Mm. And so it's a rare phenomena that occurs. And yet, even at that point, you have varying facets of experiences, even in such a rare paranormal experience for the people.
Mm. I certainly agree that they are sort of rare within the broad scope of spontaneous experiences that people have day to day, compared to a sense of presence or a premonition or a telepathic experience with a twin or a sibling or a loved one. So they're in there, but they are in a minority, but they are happening day to day. And whenever I mention telephone calls from the dead or other strange telephone calls, I do get people that email me or message on social media saying that they've had a strange experience. I think it was Dr. Massimo Biondi, who's an Italian parapsychologist and medical doctor, who looked at this as well in the 1980s. He hit the nail on the head in terms of saying, you know, they're out there, but the main problem is they are costly. It requires a lot of time of any researcher to actually ask for these cases, find them, follow up, interview the person that says they've had one of these cases, interview anyone else that witnessed them having one of these telephone calls, follow the paper trail, get it typed up and then read it through again, ask any further questions you may have. And that's just one case. And they looked at 50 cases in the 1970s, and that was between Rogo and Bayliss. So they were a duo in this. They were doing very well. And this was their full-time income and living to research these kinds of things and any other strange experiences as well. Mm. Same for me, but in a way, I treated this as a side project. Right now, I've got a colleague in France who's a sociologist, Laurent Kasprowicz. He has done a book called Des Coupes de Fil de la Aude Ella, which is essentially phone calls from beyond. Oh. And he has done the same as well, if I pronounced any of that right. Je ne sais pas, je ne comprends pas. But he's tried his best. And he's on similar path that, you know, those cases are out there. But, you know, you've really got to take your time and effort to go and research them and ask out. So I think they're just under research because most of parapsychology and elements of parapsychology that are interested in ghosts and hauntings, they're so few. So the workforce isn't there to collect them. Even within that survey that we did, I mentioned earlier Evelyn Elsa Esther's book, Spontaneous Contacts with the Deceased. That summarizes our survey of 1,000 people in English, French and Spanish speaking languages. And there were telephone cases in that. There are about 2-4% at a push out of all the experiences that were reported, but they are there. It's just having someone that has the time, you know, sometimes the money to actually pay for their time to do it. I mean, I've had little grants here and there to actually get some of this stuff done because it is time consuming, but they're there. And if someone's doing it, then it just seems like they're not there or they're completely lost. So it's a monetary factor of having the right researchers to actually spend the time to actually do the legwork to get the best cases possible, research them as far as possible, collect them together, and then start to analyze and see what you've got left. It's a really big project of collecting all the wheat and doing that, doing the harvest, and then separating the wheat from the chaff and then creating the flour afterwards, which is the monetary value and what people want to know about. Which is, what is your outcome? What have you actually produced from all of this growing and harvesting? What is your product? And that is, what have you learned from this? It's a long-winded process. And if you're just one person, it's time-consuming and draining, especially when you've got other things to do and juggle as well.
Absolutely. Well, I think one of the striking cases in the book was reported by a gentleman called Harry Walters. And this is interesting on a number of levels because it involves a performing psychic or medium called Marvell, who seemed to have some kind of contraption that he claimed people could speak to the dead through, Cal. Mm. This report is both fascinating on a sociological level. It's fascinating on a psychic level. And it's also strange in regards to this very niche aspect of the paranormal, because as we were talking about before we started the interview, this seems to be one of the extremely rare, if not the only case, where someone's called the dead. The dead haven't called them.
Yeah, so Roger and Bayliss found a few, but when I did my own analysis of 50 cases, this was the only one within the case set that I could find that exemplified calling the dead rather than the dead calling you. So it is the standalone N equals one. But it was from a journal article that was in Rogo's files that sit in the California Institute for Integral Studies in the Rockefeller Library. Mm-hmm. So it's in all of his files there, and I had it copied for me around about 2010, something like that. And I've since been to the library in San Francisco to go through all of Rogo's material. But it's a very strange case. So this is when you had your psychic performers on stage well before the time of Derren Brown, where they would appear as someone from the Far East and mystical and yet wearing a tuxedo and a turban.
Yes.
that would be full of just beautiful textiles and jewels and so forth, saying that they are in contact with the dead or could give you visions of your future. Very much like when you watch the film Big with Tom Hanks and the Zoltar machine. And Zoltar, if you can find them at, you know, beautiful seaside or not so beautiful seaside resorts in the UK,
yes,
and you put your pound in and Zoltar will nod his head back and forth and his eyes will glow and he will spit out from the machine some sort of premonition about your future. So it's this idea of the fortune teller, and this fortune teller is on stage. What they had was this idea that they had on suspended ropes this telephone that would go out into the audience with a glowing light. But if it ended up with you, you would pick it up and he would channel the spirits of the dead to talk to you. He would have to stand specifically to begin with on a plate, a metal plate on stage that the audience couldn't see, that was connected to metal pieces on his shoes that would then go up through his body to a receiving wire so he could hear via a hidden headphone set that was under the turban. So he got these headphones on by his ears to communication off stage from a stagehand, be it male or female, that was switched to suit the person, speaking from the audience, thinking they were speaking to a dead grandmother or grandfather and getting messages. And it was just a lot of cold reading, essentially, and they'd be looking for as many hits as possible. And I guess the marvel on stage, he would be facilitating the conversation and saying, and what are they asking you now? Oh, I hear they're asking you about this. And so the audience get a glimpse of what the telephone conversation is about. And they adapted this a bit further so that the radio system was a bit better, so he could actually walk up and down the stage. He wouldn't have to be just stood on this metal plate.
Mm.
And the whole story evolves around one day, some guy had been an audience member and he was so fascinated by this and the call that he'd received from his wife, that he wanted to pay the marvel for a private one-to-one with a telephone call. And this guy had gone backstage, and the marvel was there, and he was quite taken aback by this guy had come backstage and wanted this one-to-one. And he thought, oh, I'll give it a shot. This guy's offering cash in hand for it. One of the stagehands is probably there. When he picks up the phone, they'll get an alert that we're using it, and they'll just improv. And the guy does it, and he gets a very satisfactory telephone call from his wife. And puts the phone down and he goes away, happy as Larry. Who is this Larry who is so happy that we can compare ourselves to, right? And so Marvel then goes to the dressing room thinking that his partner or one of the other stagehands is there on the receiving element, the transmitter, and looks and no one is there. Where are they? Well, it turns out that while they were just in the middle of the day doing setups of the stage and dress rehearsals and what have you, there'd been a fire a couple of blocks away at a building, and so many people were fascinated by what was going on that all those people involved in the stage work backstage had left the theatre. Little did the marvel know. And they'd gone out through the stage door and gone to see this fire. No one was there on stage or backstage but him.
Mm.
And so he was like, this is strange, because he got the headset on and he could hear this guy talking to a woman that was giving him very comforting and confirmatory information about his experiences. The guy came back later and offered money for the telephone, thinking it was legitimate. And I guess the marvel at that point thought, you know what, I'm done with this trick, this stage performance. Yes, he can have it, and took the money. And years later, he was performing, well, not performing, he'd become a church pastor in a spiritualist church. And he saw this guy sat in the audience, and he thought, oh, I better not mention this time that I was a performer on stage and this happened, and I believed it to be a genuine spiritualistic experience, because I'll be mocking this guy. And he didn't mention it. But the guy came up to him afterwards, one-to-one, shook his hand, said, thank you so much for selling me the telephone. And he said, well, why? What's happened since? And he said, every time I need my wife, every time I'm in a moment of despair and I just need her advice, if I pick up the telephone, she's there on the other end. And she gives me those words of comfort or advice. So that's essentially how that story goes. So it's more so you pick up the telephone and the person is there. And in this instance, it was meant to be a trick. It was completely fraudulent. That's how it was set up to be. But for this one individual, even beyond the stage performance and then keeping this fake telephone, he believed that afterwards he was still receiving word from his wife. And the marvel had heard it. He'd heard it over the transmitter because he was hearing in on the headphones. So he'd heard this additional woman's voice. And as far as the story goes, it continued thereafter.
Remarkable, really, that one. Because that's, I think, because of the way it affected Marvel, and it seemed like it changed his whole philosophy to how he performed, as it were, that it kind of convinced him there was more to this than just parlor tricks, Carl.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the only way I can see it as well. But that's why he gave up the theatre. And I suppose in some ways, through what he'd experienced, he wanted to help the community. And he became this, I don't know, spiritualist representative, pastor, whatever you might call it. He was running and being the head of a spiritualist church and often talked about this experience as being fraudulent. And so, yeah, completely changed his worldview. And it wasn't because of any personal bereavement or anything. It's because of him witnessing someone else's experience.
I think the Dr. Jones case, which is later in the book as well, is fascinating because of several reasons. It goes on for several years. It's excellently documented, although we don't have too much sort of meat on the bones of the keeping a list of the calls, Cal. But it's interesting that the person who was seeing their mother receive these calls, to them, it ended up seeming as though it was entirely perfectly normal. But one of the aspects of this that I've heard in several cases that I've read about is that there seems to be this kind of wind noise when the receivers are picked up, mm-hmm. like a whooshing, as though it takes this noise to come through before it clears the line, as it were. And yet, here we have this woman who had lost a dear friend who suddenly started receiving calls for a considerable period of time from someone that clearly meant a lot to them, and they meant a lot to each other, it would seem, which I'm a bit confused about because she was married as well. But this is remarkable because Dr. Jones, as the pseudonym is, says that in certain occasions the calls would last up to 20 minutes.
Yeah. Odd, very odd. And he reported this to me as an adult. So he remembered it as a kid, and he was always interested in, well, what on earth had his mum written in these diaries? So as you mentioned, the circumstances were that this man and wife had completely split up. They were both pursuing their own relationships. For her, it was a childhood sweetheart, and her husband had gone off to find new relationships. But for monetary issues and perhaps to keep things as consistent for the kids, they were still living in the same house. That can't always be easy, but I guess they somehow found their way through it and it worked for them, so fair enough. But she got this childhood sweetheart. He passes away. He's in the hospital. She had regular phone calls via the kitchen telephone that she would take on. If people remember them, sometimes they had a very long cord. She could take it off to the bathroom and shut the door and still have the cord attached, and she'd have her conversations. And they would be 15 to 20 minutes at a time. And she documented them in her diaries that would be quite extensive blank diaries that she could fill in that would be 2 to 3 years at a time. And this goes up to 5 years worth of records. And when you read them, they don't really give much away as to what's being said. Thursday morning, my darling called to say that he loved me and that I was sad and that he would be at my side. He said, be happy. And I felt happier. and now I must leave my sweet little dove. I will call again soon. That they don't really give away much, except for just these words of comfort and confirmation, and that there was one point where all the family remember that he had died, and yet a couple of weeks later, she comes in white as a sheet and said, Richard's just called. And everyone thinking, what? What did you call the police, the ambulance, the fire brigade? No one knew about the Society for Psychical Research or any universities dealing with this. So they just accept these very strange calls 2 to 3 times a week. If it's fraudulent, which my good friend John Randall, the late John Randall, biologist and psychical researcher, thought, he said, you know, don't ever think that fraud and pranks aren't going to be involved. Some people are just naturally very cruel.
Yes.
That's what humanity is like. There can be some very evil people out there. There are. And there's various psychological reasons as to why that we could go into. But ultimately, there are some people who are naturally very negative. And they might go out that way to prank someone who has lost a loved one and keep it up. And they've kept this up for 2 to 3 years or so, or perhaps even a little bit more, if it indeed is a prank. But Dr. Jones, who became a doctor of psychology and sociology later on in life, he's about 12, 13, 14 at the time. And there was one instance where this Richard calls at a time when he's meant to call, but the mother is out. And so he answers the phone and he hears the sound of wind and static, as though the voice is coming out of this distant sound, this whooshing sound. And he said he was familiar with this. His mother had mentioned it, but he was so scared, he just shouts, she's not here, and slams the phone down.
Yes.
And regrets in later life the fact that he ever did that, because he wishes, as a psychologist, what on earth were these conversations like? He wished he'd held on and just listened to this ghostly voice. So again, it happened in the 1960s. It's very well documented in these personal diaries, but not very well documented at all in terms of by any social scientist or physicist as to what's going on, or even any records with the telephone companies, or the backstory of what really was the relationship between his mother and this childhood sweetheart. So it's absolutely shrouded in mystery as to, well, you know, there's lots of potential for fraud. There's lots and lots, but we haven't got an absolute tick of the box that it was fraud. It's happening in a very typical way. This seems to link to some of these other cases that Rogo and Bayliss are reporting. So we're only left with being able to just stick it in a box with a question mark on it and think, well, its characteristics are similar, but we don't know. But it's most likely fraud. But we can't say 100% that it is.
I think the last case I want to, because I don't want to spoil any more, really, because everybody...
No, he's giving spoilers away. Spoilers, dear sir.
Is this wonderful case about this gentleman... Well, it's not wonderful, but it's wonderful in a fascinating sense. Is this gentleman called Carl in the late 60s, Carl, who has had a lot of stress going on in his life, and he just decides to get away from everybody, and he goes to the coast and ends up renting a room in this lovely old lady's property. And he receives a call on a telephone that's not connected. And the aspect of this that really interests me, and I've seen this in a couple of occasions, is even when the caller probably has no knowledge of where the person they need to speak to is, they're able to find them.
Yeah. I mean, that happened in another case as well by Linda Lovelace, who was a porn star. You probably read that one as well.
Yes.
And it was in her autobiography called Ordeal. Linda Lovelace was very famous for whether people listening to this watch pornography or vintage pornography or not, she was very famous for a film called Deep Throat.
Yes.
And it was her, the person that performed in that with her was her husband. And he was very abusive towards her. And she'd gone to a motel at some point and was being abused by him and beaten up and so forth. And she said at one point she thought about her protector, which was always seen as her father. And she just wished her father could come and help her and get her out of this terrible relationship. And suddenly they got a knock at the door in this hotel room, this motel. And it was her mum and dad. And she said, what are you doing here? And he said, well, you called and said you needed help, so I've come to pick you up. And both her and her husband were dumbfounded because he'd been watching her like a hawk, this narcissistic, terrible, psychological and violent domestic abuser.
Yes.
And she'd not been anywhere near the telephone. And she was adamant she'd not been near the telephone. But someone had called with her name and her cry for help and saying exactly where they were.
Mm.
And yet she found this experience so strong and important that she's included it in her autobiography. The same happened for Billy Connolly, the famous Scottish comedian Billy Connolly. He'd gone to a theatre that was known to be haunted, and he'd spoken to a little chap backstage who was sat on a table, And Billy said, "How's it going out there?" And he said, "It's not so bad. It's filling up." And so Billy thought that the theatre was near enough full by that point. So he goes out to look, and actually people are still taking their seats, and he's gone out at the wrong time. So very embarrassing that the performer's already walked onto stage. But Billy's distracted by the fact that two people are fighting about five or six seats up from the very front of the stage. So he goes down into the theatre and asks, "What are you fighting over?" This guy's punching him, and I won't say exactly what he was saying as he was punching him, and that the wife was looking on, but he finds out, "What's this story about? Why are you attacking this guy?" And he said, "Oh, he's taking my seat." And he goes, "What happened?" He said, "I had seats to come and see you perform, and someone broke into my car. I kept them in the glove box. I knew exactly what seats I booked for me and my wife. Someone nicked my car, and I thought, well, I'm going to find whoever nicked my car, because I know what seats I bought, and that person, so-and-so, will be sat in my seats." And he found seat, I don't know, E4 and 5. And lo and behold, this man and woman are sat in seats E4 and 5, and he's beaten the man. And this guy, innocently, has got seats E4 and 5, him and his wife. He bought them from someone in a pub. Yes. So he's bought them in all honesty, not realizing that, you know, it's related to a car theft.
Yeah.
And Billy settles the whole thing down. And he goes backstage again, and that little man isn't sat there, who said, "Oh, it's filling up, it's all quiet." And the next day, or after the performance, he asked them, "Oh, who was that chap who sat backstage? You know, he was there to announce me." And they said, "What little man that sat backstage?" And he describes him, and they said, "There is no little man who sits backstage. A lot of people have seen him. He's our theatre ghost. He doesn't exist." And Billy just thought, he just took it on the chin. He thought, well, that's weird. He'd had a conversation with the guy, but he wasn't any known person. And obviously, because of security and that, they're not just going to let anyone sit backstage.
Yeah.
So like the Linda Lovelace instance, like that, the instance with Carl, I don't want to give it away. I'm not going to kind of recite what the experience was. It's a disused telephone. He's gone away. No one knows where he is. And yet a call from the deceased exposes where he is and prompts him to call home. So check out the book. Check out Telephone Calls from the Dead. Check out that instance. It's a very popular one that since the original book in 1979, and since my book, Telephone Calls from the Dead, people in YouTube videos and other things have recited that one because they find it quite an interesting one.
Yeah. I think one of my favourite paranormal phone calls, and it obviously not really covered because it's kind of the opposite. It's one of those strange ones. It's tied up, Cal, with everything that goes on with the infamous Flight 401 and the legends of the ghosts that came afterwards, which was I think the week before the crash. Was it the week or well anyway preceding the crash, Don Repo, who was the flight attendant on the flight navigator on the ill-fated journey, his wife received a call at home while she was preparing dinner to tell her that Don had been killed in a plane crash. And she'd no idea, and she was absolutely devastated. Ironically, he was on the same flight going the same route when that call came through, I believe. And therefore, that only came to light when Fuller, the guy who wrote the book, Ghosts of Flight 401, started doing his research based on friends telling him who worked in the airline industry, who obviously all wanted to speak under the cover of anonymity because they didn't want to lose their jobs or get grounded. And that was one of the things he discovered once he found out the contact details for the family and approached them and explained what he was trying to do. And they were quite welcoming because they'd heard that Don was appearing and trying to help people on other flights. And that one, it's one of those weird things that you think, well, was it a precursor? Was it a predictor? Or was it, as we could say, you could say that was someone playing a sick prank, but you would suggest that people in the airline industry don't usually phone each other up for a laugh to pretend they've been killed.
Yeah. No, you wouldn't expect that. I mean, they all tie in very well with what we call crisis apparitions. And so you might have a distinct vision of someone or even a dream of them. And in these instances as well, telephone messages as well, where you don't know of what their actual fate is. You don't necessarily know that they're on their deathbed. And yet you receive information that you think is directly from them, or these very strange visions, and lo and behold, afterwards it ties in with the fact that the person was dying or was dead at the time that you had these experiences. So even now in psychical research, we're looking into these with that survey that I mentioned that we've just done, to look at, are these still occurring? And they are still occurring. We have to ask some very specific questions to make sure people recognize, have you had one of these experiences? Because we're talking about 12 hours leading up to death, and 12 hours afterwards as well. But they were noted in old books, even in the early 1800s. So some time before psychical research even started surveying these experiences and discovering that these were a common thing as well. Mm. But you've named a really good book there, The Ghost of Flight 401, and also The Airmen That Would Not Die.
Yes.
I recommend anyone listening to this to go and check out those books. They're really good.
Well, I would also add to make sure that they pick up your book, Cal, because it's this fantastic addition to any lover of the paranormal or parapsychology library that anybody wishes to build up an even more in-depth look into certain aspects of this wonderful phenomenon. So before I let you go, so what's next for you? What's your next project? Are you planning anything else? Because, like I say, this book is a wonderful addition to my library, and I'm sure it would be for many of my listeners as well. So I'm eagerly awaiting your next project.
Oh, bless you. I'm glad people are enjoying Telephone Calls from the Dead, and you have, and you've read it so thoroughly. So that makes the past me, the 21-year-old me that finished writing that when I was down in Portsmouth, very, very happy. I can't believe how much time has actually passed by since then.
Yes.
That I'm now 35. And
yes.
It's still doing well. But I'm going to revamp it. I want to do another Telephone Calls book that takes aspects of that, and I'll rewrite it and I'll deal with the chapters. That's in the pipeline, the immediate pipeline. But straight away, I'm just finishing off. Steve has already done his part. I did edit a book with Steve Parsons called Paracoustics, Sound and the Paranormal.
Mm.
And we've got a companion book to that called Paravision. So that's looking at paranormal aspects of sight and human vision. So it's an anthology. We've done most of the starting chapters. And then the contributing chapters in the end are by various colleagues that have some sort of say in that domain. And there's a lot of crossover with vision to aspects that Steve and I haven't necessarily looked into. So it's a really good volume. If anyone gets hold of a copy already that exists of Paracoustics, read it, whatever chapter interests you, just read the chapter. It's not meant to be read all the way through as a page-by-page book. Look through the table of content, find a chapter that you think that's an interesting chapter, read it, because it doesn't necessarily relate to the others. It's just about sound and the paranormal and that particular topic. The whole book encapsulates it, and that's what will happen with Paravision, which hopefully will be out before the end of this year. I'm also working on D. Scott Rogo's biography, so that book will come out. And I've got a few other books in the pipeline as well, but those are the immediate ones. Another telephone book, Paravision, and a biography for D. Scott Rogo. And there are others that will come. I'm just so busy. I'm juggling 11 doctoral students that run under me in supervision. So those are whole projects and theses in themselves on different things. I've got different articles that I'm working on and independent writing. So different things. Follow me on Facebook under Cal Cooper, and also Callum E. Cooper on Twitter or X, as it's seen. And if you go to Amazon and buy Telephone Calls from the Dead, just click on my name when you see it there, and you'll see some other things related to what I've done as an author, be it edited books such as Paracoustics or Science Psychotherapy. And I've done forwards to books such as Scott Rogo's Parapsychology, A Centre of Inquiry, or Psy Wars by Craig Wheeler. I did the forward to that. So I've dabbled here and there. I've got forwards, I've got book chapters, I've got edited books, I've got single author books. Follow me and you'll see what's going on. Or even on TikTok. I do TikTok videos. So go on TikTok, look at dr.cal cooper, and you'll find me on TikTok. I do keep on doing promotion videos for what I'm doing.
Yes, I've noticed numerous telephone calls ringing in your vicinity recently.
It's helped, though. I mean, it's shameless publication at the moment because it's helping the book sales. So I've got no shame in pushing Telephone Calls from the Dead. I've probably mentioned it over a dozen times already, and you have Telephone Calls from the Dead. It's out on ebook and on print on demand, so you can get a copy of the paperback, or if you enjoy Kindle, you can get your electronic copy.
Brilliant. Well, I'll put links for everything in the show notes. Thank you for a fascinating, enlightening and amusing conversation. It's been great to finally get a chance to talk to you about a variety of topics, so thank you for your very kind time and conversation, Cal, and I hopefully look forward to the next time we speak.
No, that'd be great. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for your compliments, and thank you for reading the book so thoroughly. It's been nice to talk about some of those cases in depth. It's jogged my memory, so that's good, and I hope everyone enjoys it too.